Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Montel Weekly Podcast, bringing you energy matters in an informal setting. Over the past few weeks, concerns have grown over the stability of the global financial system in the wake of the failure of Silicon Valley Bank and the rescue of Credit Suisse by UBS. What is the root of the turmoil, and could it trigger another global banking crisis? What are the consequences for the energy sector and the rollout of renewables? Could the energy transition be slowed down by increased costs of financing projects? Helping me, Richard Sverrisson, to discuss what's happening in the global financial sector are Lucy Eve of Eurasia and Tina Saltvedt of Nordea Bank. A very warm welcome to you both.
Thank you, Richard.
Let's start with you, Lucy. What happened to Silicon Valley Bank and Credit Suisse? Were the same root causes here?
So I think there are several factors that make Silicon Valley Bank an outlier and that led to its collapse. Firstly, the bank's clients were very concentrated in the US tech startup space, which meant that they had very little diversification when conditions got tougher for their core clients in a higher interest rate environment. They had a very large share of uninsured deposits, which made them a lot more vulnerable to deposit outflows. And on top of that, their assets were very concentrated in long-term bonds, which had low credit risk, but on which they had experienced substantial unrealized losses on the back of those rapidly rising interest rates. Normally, absent big deposit outflows, the bank would have expected to be able to hold those assets and those bonds on their books until they matured and would very likely be repaid in full on those assets. However, what we saw in an environment of rapidly rising interest rates and rapid deposit outflows, they were forced to rapidly sell those bonds to meet those outflows, and that locked in losses for them. In many ways, Silicon Valley Bank was an outlier, given it had a very high share of uninsured depositors and a very concentrated client base. On top of that, they had poor risk management of the bank's interest rate risks and losses on assets that were equivalent to a very large share of their Tier 1 capital. So though there are other small and medium-sized banks where there are some similar concerns about that flight of deposits and the unrealized losses on those so-called held-to-maturity assets, there's also no guarantee that we could return to low inflation after a period where interest rates were low and markets were forgiving for so long. So we're likely to see tighter global liquidity conditions on the back of that. So overall, we would think that the Credit Suisse situation is quite different to that. While the Credit Suisse crisis was brought about by this global anxiety about bank stocks following the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, and which the crisis in Credit Suisse was accelerated also by the bank's biggest shareholder, Saudi National Bank, saying that it wasn't willing to provide further support. That said, Credit Suisse's problems go a lot further back than that. So Credit Suisse has suffered from a series of scandals, risk management issues, and had been a big underperformer for some time, with big question marks around its profitability for a while. And that all came prior to the Silicon Valley Bank developments and to the rapidly rising interest rate environment. Similarly to Silicon Valley Bank, they also saw a very rapid withdrawal of deposits, but instead it was from their wealth management clients. And that was really what triggered Swiss officials to need to step in. So in terms of the commonalities that we can see there, concerns about higher interest rates and its impact on the bank's business models, as well as poor risk management and sharp deposit outflows, were factors that were in common at both banks, even if the business models or exact causes of the collapses were somewhat different.
Excellent. Thank you for that summary, Lucy. I mean, if I can turn to you, Tina, you work in a bank. Are people very concerned?
I think they are a bit concerned because the market volatility has increased a lot. And you have seen central bank trying to stabilize it, and still, you know, the volatility is there. So I think what we're worried about is how long does it last for, and what should actually take it to stabilize a bit more.
Absolutely. I mean, Lucy, this is in California and Switzerland. These are robust, economies, well-functioning countries. They're not unstable countries at all. So could the turmoil spread beyond there, do you think?
I think absolutely. I mean, we're not talking about emerging markets or highly indebted, vulnerable emerging market economies here. We are talking about the US and Switzerland. But I think what these episodes have shown us is that confidence in banks and investor faith in the security of their deposits can really evaporate very quickly. So under normal market conditions, we would assume that deposits, in particular retail deposits, and especially those that are insured, do prove to be quite sticky in normal market conditions. But clearly that can change overnight very quickly if there's investor panic. So I think we've seen this very rapid and large tightening in global monetary policy, and we're still seeing sticky inflation. So that does mean that interest rates are likely to remain high for some time, even if we are seeing markets start to price in more of an easing towards the second half of the year. And that environment of still high interest rates for some time does pose a risk to banks' profitability and a risk of further deposit outflows as depositors look for better paying alternatives than the returns that they're getting on bank deposits. On top of that, we also have the fact that monetary policy tends to operate with a lag. So it's not clear that we've yet seen that cumulative impact of all of the rate hikes and monetary policy tightening actually flow through in full to the real economy. So I think on the back of all of that, we're unlikely to have seen the end of the crisis, and we would expect markets to continue to test these perceived weak links in the system.
Mm. And the weak links, would they be within the banks, regional banks, smaller bank? I mean, not the, you know, there were even jitters around Deutsche Bank last week.
Yeah, so I mean, I think if we're talking about the biggest, most systemically important banks, we're in a very different situation to how we were prior to the global financial crisis and the European sovereign debt crisis. So those big systemically important banks are much better capitalized than they were pre-crisis and should be relatively resilient. But I think we are still likely to see some stress at some of the smaller and medium-sized US banks. I think one particular focus is their exposure to US commercial real estate. So that would be one watch point that we're carefully looking at in terms of the potential contagion from that sector to the balance sheets of some of those smaller regional banks. So I think if we see a more rapid pullback on commercial real estate commitments and losses on some of those assets, we could see that drive continued concerns about that sector. I think if we're thinking about the European outlook as well, European capital and liquidity buffers are in a much position again than they were prior to the financial crisis and the European sovereign debt crisis. But I think as we can see from the recent pressure on Deutsche Bank, a bank where profitability and capital buffers are a lot stronger than where they were at Credit Suisse, and with overall a lot stronger fundamentals, investors are likely to test other banks and look to hedge their exposures to the European banking sector more broadly. So even though we think that fundamentals are much stronger now, we may well see more pressure to come.
Mm. Now, before I turn to Tina and ask more about the impact on the energy sector, if I can ask you, Lucy, you know, the rescue of Credit Suisse by UBS, what does this say about the reputation of Switzerland? You know, has it come out of this tarnished?
So I think the structure of the deal itself was controversial in several ways. I think one of the core challenges and controversies regarding the deal was the treatment around so-called AT1 or additional tier one debt. Now that's expected to be, or intended to be, the riskiest type of debt in the capital structure and to be converted into equity if a bank's capital ratios fall below a certain level. And that debt was written down to zero in the case of Credit Suisse. But what was controversial about the deal is that equity holders, which are meant in theory to absorb all of the losses before debt, including the AT1 debt, is hit, will still receive some recovery value as part of the deal. So that decision that was made does upend this traditional capital structure by giving those equity holders preferential treatment to the bondholders. And that has led to contagion in the broader European AT1 market. So I think in terms of the crisis response and the reaction by other regulators and other countries, EU and UK regulators did welcome the fact, as well as the US, that Swiss officials stepped in to broker a deal between UBS and Credit Suisse, but they did distance themselves from that critical element of the plan on the treatment of AT1 debt. So they've reaffirmed their stance that bank equity holders should take losses before AT1 holders, in contrast to the Swiss move, as they've looked to try and contain that broader spillover to European banks. But I think there's really some still lingering frustration among EU policymakers that confidence in AT1s, which were developed post the European debt crisis and global financial crisis as a new tool that was meant to strengthen European bank balance sheets and act as a buffer in terms of crisis, was so rapidly undermined by the move by Swiss officials.
But Switzerland obviously not in the EU either. So
yes. And I think that it's not just frustration on the European side, but the fact that regulators sidestepped the need for a shareholder vote was quite frustrating for some. And also, there are a lot of unhappy investors in the Gulf. So I think it comes as a political black eye in particular for some of the Saudi and Qatari investors that recently invested large stakes in those companies and will be nursing steep losses on the back of that.
Oh, excellent. Thanks for that explanation, listening. I think, but what, Tina, what does this mean for the energy sector and particular for the green transition? I mean, obviously the cost of capital is going to increase, you know, obviously liquidity could be an issue. But have you seen any consequences already?
Well, I think in the short run, it's often that you see that investors pull out of commodity markets as such when uncertainty is moving up. This is what we have seen during the old euro crisis, like the banking crisis and the financial crisis in 2008. We saw that during the oil crisis in 2014. So when the volatility is increasing, many sells out of the commodity markets, often seen as more a more risky market than a few other markets. So that is what we have seen. We've seen the commodity prices dropping a bit as well. But I still think, you know, it might be short term because the development we have seen in the energy markets are often more longer term. Investments you do are more longer term. And of course, if you talk about renewables, we've seen a completely different situation, at least for the last year, with the war in Ukraine and the need to search for energy sources that is not linked to Russia, for example. So I think it's not unusual to see this kind of sell-off in the very, very short term, but I'm not really sure how long it lasts for, because I think investors will be willing to go into, especially in Europe, into renewables again. Quite soon when the market stabilizes. Mm.
So when you say a sell-off, that's mainly we've seen an oil's been the main driver here that's been falling or in the last 2 weeks affected by this banking crisis.
Sure, I think oil, we've also seen that energy prices such as natural gas has been falling, but that's been lasting for a bit longer. So you both have the macroeconomic situation, which saying that we're going into a period of time during the year when we don't need that much energy. And that has, of course, helped as well to slow down the prices. Because we're going into the spring season where temperatures are rising. At the same time, you know, it has been discussing if actually how would the effect be when China opens up a bit more after the COVID closed down. And so far, we haven't really seen that has been pushing up the energy prices very much. So I think, you know, this kind of crisis going in, this time of turbulence, I would rather say it's too early to say if it's a crisis in the banking sector, but the turbulence hitting the banking sector has, of course, hit, you know, all kinds of investments. And I think it's a bit risk off at the moment.
Exactly. Do you think then it could delay or slow down the deployment of renewables in Europe? Or as you say, that's more of a long-term investment and maybe that could not be so affected?
I think still, you know, it's a bit too early to say, because if this lasts for a couple of more weeks and then it quiets down, you know, I think it wouldn't have affected investments in renewables that much. And the reason why is that Europe especially is so keen on building up or getting less and less dependent on the Russian oil and natural gas. So I think it's needed to make these investments for other reasons that, you know these pure speculative changes. Also, we have seen that the US, for example, with the IRA coming in, the competition is increasing between China, the US, and the EU, who's going to take the lead of driving the renewables. Investments. So I think still, you know, it takes a bit more than a few weeks of turbulence to actually stop it. It could actually slow it for some weeks. So, but in the longer term, I think it's I think the willingness to invest in renewables of political reason are quite high at the moment.
And there's quite a lot of money sort of swilling around. You mentioned the US, the Inflation Reduction Act, and also there's a lot of subsidies available in Europe and elsewhere. But do you think you could see sort of more consolidation in the renewable sector, where, you know, smaller players could get hit by the sort of, you know, could hit their sort of credit ratings here, or their ability to be able to fund such large investments into green energy?
It might be, and I think also it's still a bit early to see that. But of course, the recent increase in interest rates, of course, put more pressure on the smaller actors within this space. So, of course, it will be interesting to follow that at least this spring and the upcoming summer.
Mm. I mean, but the banking turbulence, as Tina calls it, Lucy, not quite a fully blown crisis yet, I agree. But has there been a failure of regulation?
I think if we look at the Credit Suisse situation what caused that crisis, I think that stems from long-standing problems with profitability, with governance issues, and a series of scandals. And their management had also struggled to articulate a convincing turnaround plan for investors, which meant that confidence quickly evaporated. If we look at the crisis response by regulators and officials, for all the reasons that I mentioned before, question marks will be raised about the fact that the post-global financial crisis and post-Eurozone debt crisis playbook was thrown out of the window in the Credit Suisse and UBS deal. And they didn't follow the rules that had been developed post that period to try and improve the resilience of the European banking system. Yes, they stepped in to prevent that broader contagion, and that was welcomed broadly. But I think there will be question marks going forward about exactly how they responded. And that does pose a risk of potentially undermining confidence in the Swiss response to financial crisis situations and the implications of what that means for European debt investors.
I mean, what do you think, Tina? What should policymakers or regulators do in the current crisis? I mean, just keep a cool head, or, you know, what would be your suggestions or advice?
I think it's important that they're out there saying that we will support you, we will support the banking sector, so you don't get this panic situation and these bank runs. Because in the medium term, it's if you want to stabilize the markets, and the central bank is saying they're okay, we will support you in this turbulence, then I think, you know, that should calm it down. If you don't find any, you know, another banks or other banks that will have problems, so I think it will, you know, starting to cool down if you don't see anything more coming up soon.
Mm. What's your view here, Lucy? What should regulators do?
I absolutely agree with Tina. I think a firm and swift response by the Fed, by central banks, by officials to try and restore confidence is key here. And I think the speed and the spread of the recent turbulence, as Tina says, does kind of underscore that now is not a time for complacency, and that this rapid action by policymakers can really do a lot to stabilize market conditions and limit contagion. So I think the new facility that we've seen from the Fed and the moves to guarantee deposits in the failed banks in the US did do a lot to prevent that much broader spread to a wider range of banks, even if we still have seen some substantial underperformance in some of the regional banks that investors see as more vulnerable. So I think in terms of what regulators we'll be looking at next, I think the regulation of small and medium-sized banks is one area that people are focused on, and the move that was made during the Trump administration to roll back some of those regulations that were impacting those small and medium-sized lenders. So I think there will be a rethink about the regulation that's applied to some of those banks. And in the UK as well, there had been in December a push by the government to push through some new a lighter regulatory environment on some of the smaller UK banks. And I think it's likely we may see some sort of a rethink or a watering down of some of those proposals. So I think the regulatory regimes have been strengthened a lot in the last few years. But one area that we think is potentially incomplete still is the discussion around a banking union in Europe. So I think this will provide a new impetus for those discussions. And the debate around exactly how unsecured depositors should be protected, and the resolution plan for some of the smaller banks will be also up for more discussion.
Yep. Excellent. Tina, I mean, you mentioned earlier the impact on some commodity prices. It's been, you know, we've seen commodity prices falling. You know, given the net zero targets and the sense of ambition in Europe to green the economy, to move to the energy transition, is there a danger that some countries or regions could turn back to coal and gas amid these falling prices?
There are always a bit of risk that some of the countries that used to produce much more coal than they're doing at the moment could turn up these in the very short term. I don't think, you know, in the longer term that should be a problem, mainly because I think that they will require new investments soon as well to keep the coal production going or the coal industry going. So I still hope, I would say also, that I think this is a short-term challenge rather than medium-term and longer-term challenges, because we're seeing that the CO2 prices still are quite high. They moved up and they're still, you know, still keeping up there. At the same time, the EU want to... they have actually pushed investments in the greener industries, and they're trying to support that move. So I still think that it's too early to say that, you know, this green wave we saw the start of last year has stopped completely. But of course, if this continues for a long period of time, that could have a negative impact on the green transition. But I still think it's too early for that.
Yeah. So as you say, Tina, it's just a temporary blip, really. But we have to wait and see, you know, what happens. If it does go from turbulence into a full-blown crisis, then obviously things would be slightly different, or very different, in fact. But what's your outlook on the commodity prices for the coming weeks and months here, Tina? You know, oil and gas and carbon.
In the very short term, I think, as you're seeing, temperatures are rising in Europe. In Northern Europe as well. I think we need to see that this turbulence in the banking sector need to calm down if prices are going to move up again. And interesting to see what will happen with the inflation, the pressure on the economies as well. Because if you're seeing that real economies are slowing down as well, that will have an impact on the demand for energy. Economic growth is the biggest driver of the demand for energy as such. So, if higher inflation and this turbulence in the banking sector is dragging on, then I think you will see that commodity prices could slow down from the current level as well.
Mm. What's the view from Eurasia here on the impact on the energy sector, Lucy, more generally?
Sure. So I think if we're talking about the impact of the recent strains in the banking system on the real economy, it's clear that we're going to see a tightening in credit conditions as banks are more focused on their own financial health. But it's unclear at this point exactly how much of an effect that's going to have and what the impact's going to be on the real economy. One thing that has been quite unique about the recent situation is the continued strength that we've seen in the labor market, despite the cumulative rate hikes. So while we've seen all of the volatility in the banking sector, that hasn't really translated into a significant uptick in unemployment, and labour market conditions are still quite tight. So I think we're yet to see the full impact of the cumulative hikes and that credit tightening on job market data, which makes it harder to assess what the exact impact is going to be on commodity markets. Clearly, we've already seen a big reaction in the oil price and a substantial decline there. But I think it's too early to say how long that will be sustained for, given the amount of uncertainty around exactly how impacted credit conditions are going to be and how much that will therefore flow into consumer confidence and actual activity in terms of the services sector, manufacturing, and the impact that has on commodity markets more broadly.
And could I add something there as well? Because, of course, the crisis in Ukraine and around Russia's influence on the European commodity markets, we haven't seen the end to this, of course, and we don't still not know the full impact of how the sanctions against, you know, the Russian commodity markets and, you know, the latest implications of oil products and natural gas will have on the total market. Will we see that the Russian oil production and or crude oil and products will go to another harbor, to go to the east, for example? Or do we expect that more is going to disappear from the market? We don't still know that effect. So that could have potentially an impact on the prices going forward as well this spring and summer.
Absolutely. It's early days, and let's hope it is, as you described, Tina, a blip rather than a fully blown crisis. But Lucy and Tina, thank you very much for joining the Montel Weekly podcast.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So listeners, you can now follow the podcast on our own Twitter account, aptly named the Montel Weekly Podcast. Please direct message any suggestions, questions, or, you know, let us know if you think you have a good idea for a guest on the show. You can also send us an email to podcast@montelnews.com. Lastly, remember to keep up to date with all that's happening in energy markets on Montel News. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Thank you and goodbye.